There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to Noise in Brief, the podcast series from PR Week. I'm news editor Siobhan Holt, and today I'm joined by reporters Evie Barrett and Eliza Radu. Before we begin today's podcast, I quickly want to mention some of our awards coming up in the next few weeks. First, we have the PR Week Global Awards taking place on Wednesday the 15th of May in London. You can still buy tickets, so don't miss out. We also have the Purpose Awards held in partnership with our sister titles Campaign and Third Sector. The ceremony will take place on Friday the 7th of June at the Londoner Hotel in Leicester Square. Check out the events section of the PR Week website for more information and to book. Okay, let's begin the podcast. So one of the most read stories on PR Week UK in recent days has been the news that Ready 10 has backed a new PR agency. Evie, you wrote the news story on this. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so the new PR agency is called a working class PR agency named Work and Class. It's part of the newly formed Ready Media Group, meaning it's a sister agency to Ready 10 and its live experience comms arm, Klaxon. So the aim of the agency is, quote, to bridge the gap between brands and their often neglected working class audiences. So it's looking to change the narrative for working class people, both within the comms industry and more widely through its creative campaign work. So on a practical level, this means that the agency will specialise in campaigns aimed at working class groups by testing the work among these communities prior to launch. And it will also dedicate 10% of its resources to encouraging people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds into the PR industry through things like paid internships. It's been founded by Laura Birch, who is former managing director of the marketing agency Inkling Culture. And Laura has kind of emphasised that her reasons for founding the agency are linked to personal experience. So she grew up on a council estate and didn't go to uni. And she says she accidentally ended up in PR, calling herself an anomaly amongst her peers. She's got a lot of love for this agency concept on LinkedIn, but I wondered what you guys personally thought about it.
I think it's a really interesting idea. Rightly or wrongly, PR is often viewed as a middle-class pursuit. And we've spoken on the podcast several times that PR needs to focus more intently on different audiences and also a point from more diverse socio-economic backgrounds. So I think this could work. I'd be interested to hear what you guys think. Eliza, what do you think?
So in theory, this sounds like an amazing idea, but I'm a little bit sceptical about the execution. In the UK, I feel like it's quite uncommon for people to discuss their personal finances and salaries. So I feel like it's a bit taboo to ask someone how much they make. I don't feel like amongst colleagues, at least, there's like a lot of open conversation. I feel like in the UK, people tend to be humble. And I'm not quite sure if that's the right word, but it's the word I'm going with, where people mostly say they're kind of comfortable with their finances instead of giving you a figure. So with this secrecy, I feel like it's kind of hard to tell who is working class and who is middle class.
I thought the same thing, but Laura was asked about that kind of classification in the comments of her LinkedIn post. And she agreed that it's difficult to define, but she kind of said that ultimately it comes down to the way that you grew up. There's a bit more detail about that on the working class website. It says that, quote, being working class isn't something we grow out of, even if we succeed in a professional career or our financial standing significantly changes. The experience of growing up working class means being part of a cultural fabric that feeds our values, opinions, attitudes, tastes and behaviours. I'd be interested to hear if you guys think that's fair, because I suppose when thinking specifically about the PR industry, it does make sense to me because lived experience and perspective is such a key part of the creativity process when it comes to coming up with campaign ideas. I mean, what do you think?
Although I understand that lived experiences and perspectives is a key part of comms, I think once you move up in like social mobility, it also becomes a part of your identity. You may have been like working class, or you might have a working class background, but you're no longer a working class person. And I believe that kind of reflects in the way you think and act. Of course, your lived experiences won't change, but your perceptions will. For example, if you grew up in a council estate in South London, and now you live in a really lush house in Surrey and have new neighbours, I think that's also going to impact how you see the world. I think your values do change, even if people don't want to completely admit it.
It's definitely quite nuanced, but I think any kind of attempt at increasing different types of diversity is positive in the industry. So obviously, everyone's kind of welcoming that, and I'm sure there'll be ways of kind of figuring it out as they go along.
I think class systems have changed with time. I don't think they're as defined as maybe they once were 40, 50 years ago. You know, there are people that will have gone to university but will have been completely funded by the state to do their studying because they come from a working class background. But then, you know, if we're going off the terminology there, that would mean that they've been to university, therefore they're now middle class. And I'm not sure necessarily that is how it works. And obviously we've got industries now, you know, you've got people with degrees that are struggling because of the cost of living crisis, if we're going off that sort of classification. But then you've also got people that have never been to university, but maybe work would be classed or defined as a working class job, say if they're an electrician or a labourer, but they may be on an amazing wage and, you know, house in Hampstead or something. You know, I don't think it's as defined as it used to be anymore. So I think it could be a real challenge. And also, I'm not so sure whether focusing on being solely working class, maybe that might be a bit awkward or be a bit of a difficult thing to be focusing in on. You know, if you're from that, you might find that a bit odd. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I guess you might not want to let it define you. There's also the kind of argument that shouldn't everyone be doing this? Like, do we need an agency specifically for it? But like I say, we welcome any kind of efforts to improve diversity within the industry. I think everyone just has different views on how it should happen.
Absolutely, I agree. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think at least it is a step in the right direction. At least someone's doing something about it or trying to, and I think that's got to be commended.
Definitely. I think with the fact they're introducing like internships and schemes like that, it will definitely be amazing for people in entry-level positions. And I think that will definitely lead to like greater ethnic diversity as well.
Absolutely. Moving on, a recent PR Week comment piece from Liam Thompson from the Rosalie Group argued that boycotting oil and gas is bad PR. In this piece, he said that working with such clients isn't denialism, but rather pragmatism. What do you think, team?
I always feel like PRs are really great helpers and like storytellers. So I think that they can kind of implement change from the inside out. So simply boycotting oil and gas clients doesn't seem very pragmatic to me, because I always think, like, why not help? I don't think agencies who work with these types of clients are inherently bad. I agree with what Liam was saying. He kind of criticized the group for its simplistic binary of good versus evil and indulging in student politics. I think there will always be agencies that work with these types of clients because that's where the money is. But I know a lot of other people would disagree and not be a fan of this type of work or collaboration.
I mean, I'd slightly not disagree with you there, but I do think clean creatives is a big sort of positive force in the industry, hence why they've got so much support recently. And I think most people are aware of them, even if they're not directly a part of it. And I'm sure they're leading many of the big players to kind of tread more carefully around their controversial clients, which is a positive change. That said, you're definitely right that some people will continue to work with these profitable clients, regardless of the brief. I think Liam's point of view is a bit more popular than a lot of people would like to admit. I think it's the kind of thing that people maybe just don't want to talk about. But you'd hope that at least kind of the increased scrutiny that comes from clean creatives means that those people working with these types of clients are at least more wary and having the right conversations rather than blatantly spinning the truth, as PRs are often accused of doing.
In the last recent weeks, I've spoken to a few PR professionals who have said that they'd never work with big oil clients. But when I further questioned them on a sustainability brief or working on an ESG strategy, their answers kind of shift. And they always mention, as long as it's not greenwashing, they'd be up for it, especially with the financial incentives of working with a big oil client. And I always find this quite amusing. Obviously, it would be better if society didn't rely on these companies. But as of right now, we don't really have the infrastructure to cut out gas and oil completely. My question is to the agencies who are boycotting, how do you think you're helping? I feel like if you actually worked with these clients and put more pressure on them internally, I feel like you could make a positive change, but maybe that's just me.
I think that's the ideal, and I'm sure there are agencies that are doing that, but at the same time, there are probably agencies kind of fueling the more negative aspects of the business too. So I don't know. I think I'm not sure it's as simple as good and evil. It's a tough one.
Towards the end of the piece, Leah made a really good point about the contradictions regarding boycotting. He kind of said, are you also going to boycott plastics, the extraction of lithium and waste products as well? And if not, why? And I think that's a really valid question. Why just oil and gas clients? And I guess they are a big denominator, but they're not the only denominator.
I agree. I think it's a real interesting debate. And you can kind of see both sides of the argument. And I agree that it probably is going to be easier on the inside from a comms perspective of persuading these businesses to look at other options and take, push for more initiatives that are greener. And I do slightly agree that there is, and this is my personal view, that it does seem that is harder to do if you're on the outside. Giving a historic example would be maybe with the mining communities when those mines shut down and the communities were left, they didn't have as much. So it does make you think, is it from a comms perspective, is it better to be on the inside offering advice to these CEOs? But I completely agree that pressure needs to be done. And I think Clean Creatives, as Evie has quite rightly said, does a brilliant job. And obviously there are plenty of agencies and PRs that really do strongly agree with that. They recently hit, 1,000 that had signed up. So there is a real driving force in the sector. And you can't blame them for standing up for what they believe in. Things do need to change. And for the future generations, that is important. And I think it's great that the PR industry is leading on that. But it is very difficult. Difficult one, and I don't think we're going to fix it in this podcast. We'll return to discuss how it's gone from bad to worse for the crisis hit venue Co-op Live, but first, some quick messages.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Next up, we're going to discuss the crisis surrounding the Co-op Live Arena in Manchester. For those of you that don't know, but I'm sure you do because it's been in all over the news, the Co-op Live Arena is an indoor arena in Manchester, which has cost £365 million to build. It's one of the largest capacity arenas in the UK. And unfortunately, at the moment, it hasn't opened. It should have opened on the 23rd of April, but due to technical issues, it's had to postpone the opening several times. It's been built by the developer Oakview Group, which is in partnership with the City Football Group, which is the parent company of Manchester City Football Club, for those that don't know. The Co-op Group is a naming rights partner. As a result of the technical challenges and difficulties, they've had to cancel gigs from various performers, including comedian Peter Kay, groups like Take That, Keane, Olivia Rodrigo. And as a result, many of them have even moved their events to a rival arena in the centre of Manchester. Barry Manilow, for those that are big fans, said he's even reserved backup plan for his upcoming concert at the Co-op Live Arena. So this is a rolling crisis issue for Co-op Live. What do you guys think?
I think customers and fans will be angry, and rightly so. With events like these, there's quite a lot of planning from like the people perspective. Like, for example, you've got to think of your travel. Do you need to take time off work? If you're going long distance, do you need accommodation? If you like to wear a little outfit.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's been reports of people spending thousands of pounds that they've completely lost. And, you know, it's horrendous, isn't it?
I think the companies involved will have a really hard time regaining the trust of the public, especially in terms of credibility. I'm not really blaming them for cancelling the show, because if the venue was unsafe, it's unsafe. But I think they need to be a lot clearer with their comm strategy. Saying new dates to be announced soon on Twitter doesn't make anyone feel better, because when you're waiting to hear back for when you need to reschedule, you've also got to replan your life around the event as well. Someone on Twitter said that the company should reimburse travel and accommodation, which is a valid argument. I don't think it will happen, but a valid argument nonetheless. As someone who regularly likes to fly out to different countries for festivals, this would be one of my worst nightmares. I saw someone else on Twitter say, you guys need to stop placing deadlines and just open when it's safe, whenever that may be. And I think that's so valid.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say, postponing the opening once, I think, is just about acceptable. But to think that it'd be ready a few days later and then have the same thing happen twice more is pretty ridiculous.
Eliza, do you think there'll be like a backlash, though, for the performers? Could this really impact them on a reputational level?
I actually don't feel like they will face a lot of backlash, or in my opinion, they shouldn't face any backlash. So some artists like Olivia Rodrigo have apologised to their fans on Instagram, which I think is so amicable, but she's really not done anything wrong in my point of view.
I have more sympathy for the Co-op Group, because they've got their name attached to all of this, even though they aren't directly involved in the construction of the venue. You can see their frustration. It sounds like they're trying to hold Oakview Group to account while sort of battling all this criticism. But the issue is that people just see the headlines with the venue's name on it and don't realise who's responsible. So I imagine they're getting a lot of wrongly aimed backlash.
Co-op Group has actually shared a official statement with us at PR Week. They said they were quite disappointed with these further schedule changes, and in a statement, they made it clear that the Co-op is a sponsor and does not own or run the venue. They also said they have made it clear to Oakview Group, who are responsible for the building, that the impact on the ticket holders must be addressed as a priority.
I think even more broadly than the ticket holders and the people directly involved, it seems to be, to some extent, impacting the image of Manchester as a whole, which is really unfortunate. We spoke to Rick Gutteridge, who is the chief executive and founder of Smoking Gun, and he said it leaves a stain on the whole city's reputation and credibility to get things done, particularly as it's setting out to attract the biggest international name artists that the venue's owners state other Manchester venues could not attract or physically be able to host. So it's quite a sort of competitive environment, and they're making these claims and then potentially not living up to them in the way that they initially said they would. Rick also said that it's become, quote, a popcorn-inducing saga with more twists and turns than a whodunit. But ultimately, I think he's right in his comment that Oakview Group should be the ones to carry the can and take the lead in authoritative, transparent communications, because ultimately they are the ones responsible. Rick said that right now they're apparently declining media interviews and only offering written statements, which is an interesting approach from a comms perspective.
Absolutely. Do you think this could harm the Co-op's reputation?
I think maybe temporarily, presuming it does open fine in the end. I'm sure people will kind of, it will die down. But yeah, at the moment, it's a really difficult time for them, because obviously there's only so much they can do and their name is the one in all the headlines. So I do feel for them.
Yeah, I suppose in a way we have seen similar things like this happen in the past. You know, I'm thinking of maybe the Millennium Dome. You two might not remember that, but... there was quite a lot of scandal at the time around that, you know, there was building issues. And obviously now that's the O2 Arena and doesn't have any problems. So, you know, it's not got the same sort of issues. So, you know, and we've seen it, haven't we, at World Cups internationally when they've built stadiums, that they've also faced challenges. But I think, as you say, I think the problem lies in if they had just announced the first time that they were going to push it back by a month or however long, I think it's this constant trying to launch it and then telling ticket holders when they're in the queue the gig's not going ahead is not doing their reputation any good. And so, yeah, we can only hope that things get better and then this crisis might die down. That's all for this week's episode. Thanks so much to Eliza and Evie for their thoughts today. Before we finish, I'm going to quickly plug the PR Week UK Awards. That's our biggest awards event of the year. Get your entries in today if you haven't done already. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, please leave a review wherever you access PR Week's podcasts. Noise in Brief goes live every 2 weeks, and you can also check out our interview-based podcast, Beyond the Noise. Thank you for listening. We'll return very soon. Bye for now.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.